You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a lovely overcast day. It's supposed to clear up this afternoon. But hey, it's warm, Don. It's warm.
It is spring. Shall we go ahead and just say that? It's spring here in Northern California. We have some amazing weather coming up this week. The date of right at the moment is February 19th, 2025. Lois and I are preparing the show for broadcast on February 20. Today's high is going to be 62 degrees. We're finally bumping above 60 on a daily basis. Are we really? Look at this week ahead. The day of the broadcast will be sunny and 64 degrees. We might, by the way, get a few showers today, Wednesday. Thursday, sunny, 64 degrees. Thursday night, 39 degrees, mostly clear. Friday, 65 degrees and sunny. Friday night, 42 degrees, partly cloudy. Saturday, 68 degrees, mostly sunny. Saturday night, 47 degrees, partly cloudy. Sunday, 70 degrees and mostly sunny here in Northern California. Sunday night, 46 degrees, partly cloudy. Monday, 72 degrees, mostly sunny. Monday night, I want to apologize to those of you listening in most of the rest of the United States where you're experiencing some kind of epic Arctic event. We're going into spring here, apparently, in Northern California. Monday, 72.
Is it time to plant tomatoes, Don?
Sure. Monday, 72 degrees, mostly sunny. Monday night, partly cloudy, 48 degrees. And Tuesday, 70 degrees. We basically have a week of beautiful sunny weather. Let's take a quick look at the forecast discussion. Extended forecast. Is there anything out there that's going to rain on us? Sunday through Wednesday, dry conditions, above normal temperatures anticipated across interior Northern California. Highs in the mid-60s to mid-70s throughout the Delta Valley and foothills, 50s to 60s at the higher elevations. And breezy north winds here and there. And other than that, it is feeling very, very spring-like. Yes, I've had numerous conversations with people about tomatoes, but it's not like, is it time to plant them? It's when is it time to plant them? And
You gotta wait.
Yeah, we go by soil temperature, night temperatures, things like that. Obviously, we'll talk a lot about that as we get closer in. There is something I do post, and I just recently posted. Did I send that over to you? When do we plant? Okay, someone asked on a Facebook group. They're new to Davis, new to Northern California, and it was just more of a when do you plant your tomatoes and peppers and things like that, and when do you plant the other vegetables? So this is a real.
I got it. There you go. Can I do it?
Yes.
March. Beans, beets, carrots, potatoes, and radishes. March. Notice there's no planting in February. Mid to late April. Tomatoes, basils, regular sweet corn, cucumbers, summer squash. Flowers to plant near your vegetables can include borage, sweet alyssum, marigolds, and sunflowers. That's all mid to late April. Yeah. Now we get into May. All right, here we go. Peppers, eggplants, super sweet corn, melons, winter squash. Flowers include cosmos, zinnias, asters, amaranth, celosia, and Thai basil. Wait a minute, Thai basil is a flower?
I grow it as a flower. Yeah, it's actually a very ornamental plant. Many people use it, although people who like sweet basil will probably not like Thai basil the first time they try it because it's rather more astringent tasting, but it has a rather special flavor. But it flowers quickly. There's some really showy new ones that have come on the market that I like to plant just for the fact that they draw bees and they're very attractive. Anyway, next.
Do you eat flowers?
You can, sure. Sure.
Go right ahead, yeah.
Yeah, it's edible.
And then the last thing is in late May into June, We've got watermelon, okra, extra hot peppers like habaneros in that crowd.
Yeah, so they're broken up into plants that can tolerate colder conditions and plants that really need warmer conditions. Because with summer vegetables, we're talking about subtropical and tropical plants. In February, you notice we didn't mention February, we are still selling loads of lettuce, spinach, kale, bok choy. Some of those things, as we hit the 70 degree mark, particularly the bok choy and some of the mustards and things like that, we'll try to flower right away. By the way, you can eat the flowers. They're very attractive. They're very ornamental. They're mustard flowers, basically. Bees like them. So if your bok choy starts to stretch and go to flower, cut it and use it, or just let it bloom and enjoy the blossom. But you can still plant vegetables, cool season vegetables, through the month of February, even into March. I've got people buying and planting peas. Yes, this is like your last planting of peas. But we're still doing the cool season leafy green things now. And then we shift over rapidly into the warmer season things. But everybody wants to jump the gun. So as you know, if you're a longtime listener to the Davis Garden Show, we don't really recommend planting tomatoes in the ground until about the third week of April. Typically, that's when the soil temperature, the night temperatures, whichever metric you prefer to go by, gets to where it needs to be. We really don't recommend putting in key ones, peppers and eggplant, until we get into May. Personally, May is my active planting month for summer vegetables. Yes, some of them can go in earlier than that. And of course, we'll talk more about that as we get closer into that time of year. You can be planting the seeds of some of those things now, if that's your inclination. Now, I got to mention something. This is a nursery industry thing. Someone's saying, are you going to have six packs of tomatoes? And I'm just getting to the point where I'm just going to say no. Why? Because my growers barely do them anymore. They barely do six packs of tomatoes for a couple of reasons. One, it's more profitable to do single pots. Two, you get a better plant, in my opinion. You get a bigger root system. Three, most importantly, I have very few customers who want six of one variety of tomato.
Yeah,
it's hard for me to imagine planting six of any one type of tomato. So you'll find them out there. But someone sent me a picture from Home Depot, I think it was. They were selling tomatoes in these interesting little three packs. Other places do little four packs. But in general, the industry is migrating for a bunch of reasons, cost of inputs primarily, you know, cost of labor, cost of the soils, cost of the fertilizer inputs have all gone up and up and up. And they just need to do a higher profit, higher return size. And so they're all going to the 3.5 or 4 inch pot. And if you really need large numbers of a particular variety, the reason I'm mentioning this now, I'd suggest you start them from seed yourself, because that's the way you're going to get a quantity of any one particular variety economically. Most places are going over to single pots. I have four different vendors that I buy vegetable starts from. One of them occasionally has some six packs. That's it. Almost everything else they do is in 4-inch pots. All my other growers are 4-inch pots. So that's just the reality of how the nursery industry is going for a bunch of reasons. Again, for most home gardeners, one of them sent me a picture of six packs of cherry tomatoes.
What?
I can't imagine planting.
One cherry tomato is too much.
For most people, yes. So if you're growing for like a collective or a co-op or something, you know, you're planting enough for several households, I could see maybe doing six of one variety of cherry tomato. No, I really can't see doing six of one variety of cherry tomato. So anyway, digression, but a little early for those, but happy to have the conversations about why your tomatoes didn't do so well last year, which varieties we're going to recommend this year. And you can also find all that information on the homepage, linked on the homepage at redwoodbarn.com. KDRT is community radio. That's public radio. If you like the Davis Garden Show and all the other great programming here, well, we rely on contributions from folks like you to stay on the air. So if you like it, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. And we have, let's see, something from the Master Gardeners.
Well, we actually have a catch-up for last time, and that is the Oakland Festival. Yep. Last week when we announced that we weren't able to get into the website, I called them up, and 2 days ago the website got updated, and it now has the information, and I have a corrected URL for y'all.
Okay.
So I'm going to read this URL, and you know, if you're driving, ignore it, back and listen to the archive so that you can get this.
Yes.
Esparto Regional Chamber.com.
There you go.
And that's the base. That's the base thing. If you go there, that's good. And then if you want specific for the Alma Festival, it's the same thing. /110th-annual-almond-festival.
110th Annual Almond Festival. Wow.
That's right. That's amazing. The tour dates are Saturday and Sunday, February 22nd, 23rd. And it's from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Explore 1,400 blooming almond trees. Oh, my goodness.
Almond Festival, Quipe Valley. And by the way, if you're a photographer, many of the almond varieties, the key almond varieties in full bloom right now. So if you like to go out and take pictures of almonds in bloom this weekend, it would be a great time to do it. And the weather looks like it'll be very, very congenial.
I want to clarify something I just said. Scrolling a little bit further down, I see that the Saturday schedule is located at the Esparto Community Park. Yep. That's right there in Esparto. But the Sunday schedule has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different locations, 6, 7 locations. There's a map. And there's lots of things happening all over Esparto, Quipe, Brooks, Gwinda, Rumsey. So, hey, go check out that website.
I got an email from one of the master gardeners that they are resuming their Zoom meetings, topics of interest to gardeners in the area. And let's see, we've got an upcoming event here. Lois, you've got that in front of you.
I do. The 27th of February will be a seed starting workshop, and that's on Zoom. If you want to get announcements of these things, get the list, get on the mailing list, and you send an email to Joan Tuss. That's joan.tuss@yolocounty.gov. And then tell her that you want to get the information sent to you and it'll come.
Some of them are announced on the YOLO Master Gardeners website, which is yolomg.ucanr.edu. And they do mention that seed starting one, as well as their Master Gardener plant sales and others coming up. So you can go to their website, or you can subscribe to the YOLO Gardener newsletter and get information about these Zoom events. So they're resuming Zoom for gardeners with topics of interest in the Sacramento Valley. I'm through that.
So, Don, you sent me a picture, and I got to tell the listeners, this is the most spectacular tree flower picture I think I've seen in a long time. And it looks sort of like, I don't know, an apricot or a plum or something, but it's bright red. What the heck is this thing?
That is a red barren peach, which is one of my favorite peach trees for a bunch of reasons. Red barren, for those of you listening elsewhere in California, only needs a couple of hundred chilling hours. So it's a low chill variety. It will flower even in coastal areas, Southern California. It has spectacular double pink red. They're almost red. They're almost true red flowers. They're quite spectacular. My experience with this tree, and my tree is now about 30 years old. It's finally reaching its old age and needs to have some corrective pruning done. And I've planted a new one to replace it. But it gives a bloom that starts now. What is this? February 18th, the first one opened. And it'll be blooming for 3 or 4 weeks. It's a long bloom season on this particular variety. It sets, interestingly, my experience with it over the last 30 years, it sets lighter crops than most peaches, which is great. Actually, you might think, oh, lighter crops, that's not a good thing. No, it's a great thing.
That's a great thing because it doesn't break the branches.
I've rarely had to do any fruit thinning on this one because perhaps it's the double blossoms make a little harder work for the bees. I don't know, but it sets a nicely distributed good crop of peaches, but you don't seem to have to thin them all that much. They're good sized fruit and it's really a wonderful flavor. Red Baron is an outstanding flavor. The only downside, and I always mention this when we go to sell them, is that it's a peach that you just have to eat standing right there in the garden. Gosh, what a shame. You pick it off the tree, it's so soft that you just basically eat it right away. It's not a pie peach. It's not a freezing peach. Like many peaches, it softens very quickly. So if you grow this one, you're going to want, and you want to share them with your friends. I learned this a long time ago. 2 or 3 days before it's fully ripe, you pick it, you take it to them, you have them set it on their counter for a day or two, and it becomes soft ripe. But it's an amazingly rich flavored peach. And as I say, early bloom, it's the very first of my peaches to bloom now, a long bloom season and a really high quality and a low chill variety.
So the other thing you could do is you could have a peach eating party and invite all your friends over on the day. And wouldn't that be wonderful?
I have noticed it actually ripens over a longer period than some other varieties as well. I mean, I have several peach trees and many varieties. It's like, this is the weekend. You either eat them, give them away, freeze them, or they just spoil on the ground. This one, actually, it's a couple weeks that you're picking them. So it's kind of unusual in that regard, perhaps because of the way it blooms, you get a longer harvest season off of this one.
How do you know when? So if it's ripening over a couple of weeks, how do you know which one is ripe?
Well, that's actually a very important thing to learn with peaches. First thing is almost any of your fruit, when the first one falls, it's probably the beginning of the ripening period. I mean, that's one of the simplest metrics you can use. If they look like they're getting to color up and that one of them drops, okay, they're probably ripe. You walk up to ones that are getting close to color and you gently squeeze them. And if you squeeze them and they give a little bit, they are ripe. Pick that one and use it right away. If you know that one's ripe, you can probably pick the ones next to it and take them in and put them on the counter and they'll ripen over a couple of days. Color of the fruit in the case of peaches is a pretty good indicator. There are fruit we've mentioned many times, the color of, say, an orange, that doesn't tell you how sweet it is. That's just the rind coloring up. But in the case of peaches, plums, nectarines, stone fruits, the color of the fruit is a good indicator. And very gently squeezing them, they're rock hard. Obviously, they're several days away from ripening. As they begin to give a little bit, they're beginning to ripen. There are better peaches for multiple use. Oh, Henry, Rio Oso Gem, Loring, the Albertas. But this one is amazing for fresh eating, and it has a really good flavor, and it will produce in a wide range of territories because of the low chilling requirement. Blooming the third week of February is pretty darn early for a fruit tree to be blooming. It's blooming with the almonds and my plums, which are among the first of the fruit trees to bloom. It's Red Baron, early bloom, long bloom, showy flower, great garden plant. One of my favorite peaches. Unless you're telling me you want a peach for pie, in which case I'll sell you Loring, O. Henry, or Rio Oso Gem.
Well, Don, it's spring. I know it's only February, but it feels like spring.
It does.
It smells like spring. There's flowers coming out. So I wanted to talk to our listeners who are people who like to make arrangements, you know, flower arrangements. So if you have a fruit tree, a stone fruit tree in your backyard, and every year you cut off the new stuff that sprouted up off your plum, you know, which I do every year. Sometimes just leave a few of those in the winter. And then in the spring, when the blossoms come out, then you can prune it and you get yourself some lovely stuff for flower arranging.
They will bloom indoors. Yeah, many of them, plums in particular, are used for that quite regularly. The other that's blooming now and will continue to open indoors from a branch that you cut is the flowering quince, which are in bloom all over town. Mine have actually been blooming for about 4 or 5 weeks, but they're really at their full peak of bloom right now. So people are coming in and asking about that shrub with the red, pink, or white flowers. There's one that's salmon as well. Chenomaly, it's one of those words that doesn't sound like it's spelled at all. Chaenomeles. Chaenomeles is pronounced Chenomaly, not Chenomeles, like you might think. And its common name is flowering quince. It is a quince relative. It's very closely related to quince, which, if you don't know what quince is, that's an apple relative. Quince itself produces a big rock hard fruit that smells like the most aromatic applesauce you've ever smelled. And they are actually quite wonderful for certain things, but they're solid and hard and have to be cooked to be used at all. Flowering quince is an ornamental relative of that. It's more or less a cousin, different genus, but very closely related. It does occasionally produce this little rock hard fruit, by the way, and they make a great jam if that happens to happen. But the main thing about them is they start blooming here in the Sacramento Valley in January, and they're in full bloom in the month of February, and they have a very long bloom. They start in early to mid-January and can be blooming all the way into mid-March. So it's a showy flower, deciduous shrub. I was enchanted by these when I moved up to Northern California because we didn't do deciduous flowering shrubs in San Diego. I mean, that's just not a thing down there. One, that many of them don't get the chilling that they need. And even the ones that do, they just look kind of funny when you're in a subtropical climate. It's like trying to get fall color on your trees in San Diego. Yeah, you can do it, but it's sort of weird when you're wearing shorts and going to the beach and there's trees in fall color. So the Chenomaly is not something I was familiar with any more than I knew spireas or forsythias or weigelias or any of that group. And the one that really got my attention was the flowering quince, because you'd see these in out of the way corners in yards where nobody had even noticed them most of the year. And then all of a sudden, boom, there's this big spot of color that goes on for 8 or 10 weeks. And the bees absolutely love them because they're blooming in January. They're blooming before anything else is in flower. So it's a great way to draw not just native bees out and give them something to subsist on, but if you know you've got neighbors who are beekeepers or you're near the orchards, they're going to be coming in, going to your Chenomaly as well. So it's a very tough plant. This is the other thing about flowering quince. I have seen them under moderate drought conditions. I wouldn't say severe drought is great, but moderate drought is absolutely fine. You can prune them if you want to, but there's no need. You don't have to prune them at all. They have an interesting sort of irregular angular growth habit, which can be a real focal point at the time they're in bloom, and then they'll just be part of a background hedge the rest of the year. I have two that are in almost total shade that started out in full sun, and of course trees have grown up around them, and they still bloom just as well as they did before. So they can take sun or at least moderate shade. I don't think I'd put them in deep shade, but other than that, they're quite adaptable. And the only thing I would say about them is they're very hard to get rid of if you ever make the decision that you don't want it anymore, because it is not a single trunk plant. It's more like a barberry or a mahonia. It's coming up multiple shoots from a tight rhizome base. And so if you want to get rid of it, just chopping it down ain't going to do it. You'd have to actually dig the whole thing out. Why would you do that? It's such a wonderful plant. And the other thing about them is you have varieties now that range from little 3-foot dwarf types, probably the most popular now, a whole lot that are in the 4 to 6 foot range, which I think are really the best landscape use types, and some that get 10 to 12 feet. If you head over to wine country, St. Helena, Napa at this time of year, especially the older parts of town in those two communities, you'll see hedges 8, 10, 12 feet tall of flowering quince that are 100 years old that are just being pruned as hedges, and they're spectacular when they're in bloom. So it's one of those plants that people take for granted. They don't notice it most of the time. The only time of year I ever sell flowering quince is the month of February, because that's when people see them. You're not going to persuade someone to plant one of these in August because it just doesn't look like anything. And it's deciduous, which I know some people seems to bother them that they're going to be out of leaf in the winter. But look at the bloom you get midwinter from this thing, early winter from this thing. And it's spectacular and it's great for beneficials. So if you got a corner where you can stick in a flowering quince as part of a mixed hedge, we always like to talk about not planting a long row of one thing. Have a mix of a couple photinia and a xylostoma and a feijoa and a ribes down in the shadier end. Well, flowering quince would fit in almost anywhere in that hedge as just a sudden thing of bloom in its season and then just green background plant during the summer and of course bare in the winter. So keep that in mind as you choose the surrounding shrubs. If you look closely at Shinomaly, you'll see that they're blooming the way apples and quince and pears do, which is to say on spurs. So those spurs that bloom are very long-lived. You can leave it completely unpruned and it'll bloom spectacularly more and more and more each year. You don't have to be real careful about how you're pruning it with respect to flowering wood, but it is a close relative of quince and apples. Good news is, even though it's in that group of the rose family, and that is the group of the rose family to which fire blight is attracted or which it attacks, it does not attack flowering quince. I've never seen fire blight on Shinomaly. So let's say that one more time. Shinomaly.
Shinomaly.
Very good. A good example of why some people like to use common names, because that's a hard one to say.
So Don, I know that there are ways of deciding whether something is ripe or not. And if I've got a whole tree full of something, I can pick it off and test it and see what it tastes like and all that stuff. But when I go to the store, as I did last week, and I found a tomato that was like almost black, it was so dark. How the heck do I know when that thing is ripe?
That's a very good question. First of all, if you're finding tomatoes in the grocery store in February in California, they were obviously grown much further south. Or in a greenhouse somewhere. That's another option. There's always been an industry of greenhouse or hoop house tomatoes. Growing up as a wee lad in coastal San Diego, there was actually agriculture there. Most people find this hard to believe. But just north of where UC San Diego is, Sorrento Valley was farmland. When I was a kid, it's now a tech hub, but it was farmland. And they had little greenhouses, just passive greenhouses. They didn't even have to heat them down there, of course, where they would grow tomatoes for the fresh market. They also did a lot of cut flowers, things like that. Most of that trade has moved down to Mexico or further, or even coming up from, you know, South America. Tomatoes, of course, are climacteric fruit, as we've described many times, so they can ripen over a 5 to 7 day period after you purchase them. It is important that they be climacteric for the industry, because they can't pick them ripe and ship them to you. They have to pick them unripe at various stages of development. We've talked about this during heat waves, for example. Go out and pick a tomato that's just turning color. If you're concerned it's going to be 105 and the fruit would be damaged by that, well, if it started to turn color, that's when they pick them for the grocery store as well. When they've just started to go off of green, you can pick them, and there's a predictable stage there are predictable stages of ripening that you can follow by the color of the fruit if it's a normal tomato. But these blue and black ones are driving us crazy. I've grown them. There's not a single one that I like yet. I'm going to say that. There's not a blue or a black tomato of the new ones that have come on the market that I have really thought highly of. And when I take them in to for the staff to try them, they all have the same reaction. These taste harsh. It's hard to tell if they're actually ripe. And that's a very frustrating aspect of the new high anthocyanin tomatoes that have come on the market. Cherokee Purple, just a side note here, is an heirloom that's got a purplish brown skin. That one's fine. It changes color in a predictable manner. It becomes very sweet. It's just like a normal tomato. It just happens to be darker and a little more purple to the skin. But these other ones, my answer to you is we haven't figured it out. It should go by how they give when you squeeze them. So just like with a peach, when you squeeze it gently, it should give a little bit. Other than that, it is really a matter of sampling them. And so far, if there's a blue or purple or black tomato out there you all like, davisgardenshow@gmail.com. This would be a great time to tell us what variety it is, because I'm getting to the point where I don't like any of them. The only exception was the GMO tomato, purple tomato. By the way, we're selling seed of that at our nursery this year, just so you know, believe it or not. The GMO tomato, the purple tomato is all they were calling it, came on the market last year. It's uniquely purple through the flesh, whereas most purple or black tomatoes are just purple skin. This one was purple flesh. They inserted a gene from a snapdragon into it, which gave you a purple flesh tomato. We all had the same reaction to that one, sweet but mild. Bland was the term one staff person used. Insipid was the term I used. So the breeder stopped by my nursery. Okay. They have an office right in Davis. One of the breeders working on this stopped by. We had a great conversation. They are working on more flavorful versions of this purple tomato. They also are allowing some select retailers to sell the seed. I'm serious. To sell the seed of this tomato. Now, we don't generally talk about price on the air, but in this instance, it's a relevant data point. A packet of seed is $20. There are 10 seeds in there. So I just want to throw that out before you all come storming down to buy your GMO purple tomato seed. And he says they were aware that the flavor is mild and that they're working on richer flavored purple tomatoes. They are beautiful. The flesh was quite lovely. Everybody said the same thing. What a lovely tomato. My, it's a mild flavor. So they're getting better. But in general, blue and black tomatoes to me taste harsh. And I think that's connected to the anthocyanin content, which they've increased by this is normal breeding. This is just regular plant breeding. The anthocyanins are good for you. That was the impetus for all of these blue fruit, purple fruit, black fruit becoming, you know, so trendy and being marketed so heavily. They have antioxidants or something, and so they're healthy. I think it leads to a flavor problem, and that's our consistent feeling as I've grown every one of them. But I am more than willing to grow a new variety of tomatoes. So if there's something out there you've had really good results with, it's called blue or black, by gosh, that's davisgardenshow@gmail.com. I'll find the seed, I'll grow them, and we'll give you a report in September.
Okay, in the mailbag, I have another message from Tanya. Now, I don't know if you remember Tanya. She was the one who had hedge plants to plant on the opposite side of her fence in her neighbor's yard to, you know, give them some cover and stuff. And we did a long talk. We had several talks about what to plant and that sort of thing. So she's planted it. Everything's great. She even mulched over it because they had a weed problem. Everything's great. All right, here we go. Hi again, Don and Lois. I promise this is my last question about this project.
That's all right.
After my last email in November, I got the neighbor to order a chip drop, and we put a generous amount all around the large bed area with the newly planted plants. I gave him an old soaker hose and told him to water deeply once a week until the rains come. My final question is this: how long will he need to water until these plants are established and are drought tolerant? Were our winter rains enough, or does he need to water through the upcoming summer? I water my plants on this side of the fence, but not sure if it's enough. I just want to make sure these plants survive so that we can have a privacy hedge again. Sweet peas will fill in for the spring, and scarlet runner beans will fill in for the summer. Thank you again for being so helpful with this project. I know it's taken forever, but I enjoy the competition. conversation with Lois and her mulch pile.
There you go. We got people all over the place getting mulch piles from chipdrop.net. I think I got that right. I can't remember exactly what the soil is like in this situation, so that's going to be a determining factor in the watering. However, on my own farm, when I'm establishing plants that I know to be drought tolerant, I water them for the first full summer after I've planted them, whether it was in the summer or fall before or in the spring of that year. I make sure that about once a week, they get a very thorough soaking. A soaker hose is a great way to do it. An inexpensive soaker hose, the kind that ooze water, you know, out of pores all the way down. I use those occasionally, although honestly, they don't last that long. After a couple of years, they tend to get holes in them, especially if you have ground squirrels, as I do. But they have to run for a long time to give a really good soaking. This is the key. If he's using that kind, you know, the kind of soaker hose, it's not drippers, but it just soaks, then you need to run it for several hours or even overnight. I put in a half inch drip tubing. I put in two 2 gallon an hour emitters on each plant. This is on my farm, one on either side of the plant, on the edge of the planting hole. That way in 1 hour, I can give a plant 4 gallons of water. I typically run it for 2 hours. So I'm typically giving a plant 8 to 10 gallons of water. That's way more than the little root ball needs. My goal is to water not just the root ball, you know, the nursery soil, but the soil out and down. So I want the roots to be able to go out and down. So if I'm giving it 8 to 10 gallons of water all at once, and I do this for young trees as well, I'm talking about shrubs from a 5 gallon, trees from a 5 or a 15 gallon. I can do that on my soil, which is a silty loam, about once a week through the first summer, and I'll get very good growth. And I do that even with low water plants, things that should ultimately be able to live without irrigation. And the plants, for the record, that were used in this were pineapple guava, bottle brush, what was the other one? Grevillea. Okay, so 3 good choices for eventually being completely unirrigated if necessary. By the second summer, you could be doing that every 2 weeks. By the third summer, you could do it very thoroughly once a month. So that would be what I would do if you want to give him a really simple rule of thumb. Very serious irrigation once a week, very serious irrigation every 2 weeks by the second summer, and once a month by the third summer.
I know that she's got a really nice neighbor allowing them to plant plants on their side of the fence. I'm wondering if she couldn't set up a setup where the things on their side of the fence are all set up and ready to go, and then maybe put just one of those little quick couples on a splitter that tucks under the fence and she can reach. And that way she could quick couple a hose onto it and she could run the thing as needed, and he wouldn't have to worry about scheduling or anything. What do you think about that idea?
I mean, I do this all the time. When I do a new planting, ultimately it's going to go on to its own water line or a water line with like-minded plants. But very commonly, let's say I'm planting some low water shrubs not far from my vegetable garden. If I'm in a hurry, I'll just put a Y coupling in, as they call it, so that you can control, you know, you can have 2 lines coming out at the end of your hose. And one of them is going to the vegetable garden. The other one is going off to these new plants, and it could sneak under the fence and go by the plants on his side and then loop back into your side if necessary. So you could control the irrigation very easily from your side. And you could just make sure that once a week you'd give it a very thorough watering. That would be great because he's being, yes, very generous to allow this planting or to cooperate on this whole planting on his side when it wasn't really his concern in the first place. And it's not that expensive. The water cost is pretty nominal for this. If you want to be absolutely sure they're going to get watered in the future, maybe just ask if you can run half inch drip line under the fence from your side on a Y coupling that's coming off from someplace you're already irrigating your woody plants, your shrubs and trees. And in the first season, it would be fine if it was with your garden. That actually works very well for newly planted shrubs and trees. I would like to see them getting an intentional deep watering. That's the main difference. So she mentioned like runner beans and sweet peas. Well, those don't need it watering. So it wouldn't be necessary to run it on that same line. But yes, a quick coupling or a Y coupling so that you can control it, runs under the fence. You once a week give a really thorough multi-hour soaking or multi-gallon soaking is really what it comes down to. That would be great. And then ultimately, to get back to the key question, by the second summer, you should be able to cut the frequency. By the third summer, all 3 of those species, Feijoa, bottle brush, and Grevillea, can essentially be unirrigated. They'll grow faster. They'll look more robust if you continue watering them. But on my property, I'm really talking about once a month with each of those species when once they're established plants, which is by the third summer, really. If you have any California natives in there, it gets to be a different conversation. There weren't in this discussion. But if you happen to have ceanothus, manzanitas, fremontodendrons, you need to water them through the first summer, but you need to back off as quickly as you can because in a hot interior climate, they're vulnerable to crown and root rot. So that would be a different conversation. And it can be a bit of a problem if you've got them mixed with non-native low water ornamentals. You have to determine the watering based on the higher vulnerability of the native plants to crown rot and root rot. The one exception to that, two exceptions to that are Toyon and Coyote Bush. They can take anything as far as I can tell. The others, you know, I just had someone in who had planted a Ray Hartman ceanothus 3 years ago, and last summer it died abruptly after growing great for the first two summers. Yeah, that's what happens with them if you don't manage your watering really, really carefully here in the valley. And even if you do, it can be a problem. But with most of the non-native woody plants backing off by the third summer, you could be watering very infrequently. But almost anything here in the valley benefits from a deep soaking once a month, even when it's considered a very low water plant.
So I think that Don's interpretation of what I said was a little different than what I was trying to say. So let me do it again. Okay. Soaker hoses or drip system or whatever going on both directions from the middle of the fence, both directions out on the other guy's side, and you tuck that little Y splitter that's both of those Ys are on his side. There's two soaker hoses, and you tuck that under the fence and you put on what's called a quick couple. Then it can live there forever. You can even cover it up with a little bit of mulch if you don't want to see it. Yeah. And then when you want to water, you drag your hose over with a quick couple connector on that side. You just pop the two together and turn it on. Yeah. And that way it's very simple. And you don't have to worry about what's on the other Y. I mean, if it's your veggies or something else, it's all of it is on theirs.
Yep.
That's what I was saying.
And I would say keep it simple. This is the other thing. What people have often asked me, I'm on 13 acres. How do you water that whole place? Do you have a timer? No, I do not use timers of any kind. I have 42 valves on this property and I manage them manually, but many of them run at the same time. And almost all of them are the simplest thing in the world. It's a hose faucet. You know, I've got them all down long, long, long lines through the property. Half inch drip tubing comes off of there. I use a 2 gallon an hour output because I want to have standardized output. I put a number of them on each plant, depending on the size of the tree, how big it's going to be. And I turn them on, I run them for a long time. And everything, I've got 13,000 feet of drip tubing on this property. Okay. And I'm constantly, my main job managing this farm and residence is monitoring to make sure something hasn't chewed a hole in the drip line again. Covering them is a really good idea, but it isn't real practical for me. But it's the simplest thing in the world. You run the line where it needs to be. You have a pretty high output emitter. This is the important part, pretty high output emitter so that you don't have to run it forever to get a reasonable amount of water. But this is an important distinction. I can do that because my soil drains well. Okay, I can run a line for hours and the water goes down and out where I want it to go. If you're listening and you have heavier soil with a low infiltration rate, slow infiltration rate, you may find you need a lower output emitter so that it soaks in properly rather than running off. But bear in mind, you then have to run it a lot longer. And these discussions that we have with people all the time have to do with the use of the low output drip lines, Netafim brand being the best known. They typically have to run for a few hours to give a really good soaking. It's not inefficient for them to do so, but they do have to run for a long time. Many of our conversations about why things are not doing well after a heat event have to do with the shallow watering from low output drip systems. You just have to learn how long to run them. We can help you calculate that, but personally, I prefer a higher output dripper just so I know I'm getting what I need. My soil allows that.
So Anne from Oregon writes, our cedar. This tree was young and tiny when we moved in 10 years ago. It has thrived despite neglect and was becoming a feature we had hoped to maintain. However, a wet, heavy snow, 11 inches of snow, at our home and 600 feet above the Rogue Valley broke at least two main branches. Of course, my husband, a tree remover extraordinaire, wants to remove it. I want to keep it. if it can be trimmed to continue its statuesque shape. Can you recommend a course of action that would keep this tree and help it to thrive? I know, oh, you know, I always go to you for wisdom. Thank you, Anne in Medford, Oregon. Well, and there's a picture of the tree.
Yeah, a little hard to tell from the picture whether it just lost the whole leader or some of the side branches. Personally, my inclination is always to, okay, I just watched a fox climb up my feijoa onto the roof. So just, so you, just so you all know, foxes can climb. They're the only canids, I believe, that
can climb.
And I just watched it walk up the deck, hop up under the feijoa, climb up the feijoa onto my roof. All right, backing up here. Slight digression there. That was very entertaining. I can't really tell whether it lost its leader completely or just lost some side branches. And that is an important question. So perhaps backing up a little further and taking a picture of the tree that shows its actual full form would be helpful. Personally, I don't casually take out trees. If a conifer had lost its leader, but still was nice and full and bushy from the base, as this one appears to be, I would probably turn it into a fascinating, carefully pruned, artistic part of my garden. I would thin it out a little bit, and I would encourage some of the lateral branches, and I would turn it into the equivalent of a giant backyard bonsai tree. That's what I would do, and I think that's probably what our listener would do. But it's the husband we need to talk to here. If this tree is allowed to grow uninterrupted, unhindered, one of the branches will almost certainly form a new leader. We've talked about the hormone relations in plants and how the hormones control the shape of the plant. Well, in excurrent growth habit trees, which is Christmas tree shaped trees, excurrent, there's excurrent and decurrent trees. Excurrent is your Christmas tree shape. Decurrent is your weeping willow shape. Those are the extremes, and most other trees are somewhere in between there. Any that have the excurrent growth habit, the Christmas tree type shape, the highest bud will immediately, almost immediately, start to dominate again. So even if there's two branches that appear to be, you know, more or less trying to vie for leadership, one of them will probably pull away and start suppressing the growth of those below. If it doesn't, you have a conjoined leader and you have a structural problem. So that's something to monitor very carefully, because sometimes, as I can tell you from sad experience, a conifer will form two leaders and they'll grow together and then one of them will split out. And that's why my 30-year-old incense cedar had to be taken out a few years ago, because it had done exactly that. And when the tree service guy came to look at it, I pointed and said, looks like it's split down 6 to 8 feet. He got up there and then realized it had split all the way down to the ground and it was just going to take itself out in the next major storm. I had to have the tree taken out. So you can allow the tree, that was a long digression, but there's a point to it. You can allow the tree to regrow. One branch growing point is almost sure to eventually dominate. I don't know how old you are. This could take as much as 5 to 10 years. And then if it doesn't, if two of them do, then you need to head out one of them so that the other one can develop more fully. And over many years, the tree will take on the form it had originally, very, very likely. So you could either work with this lovely bush that you now have and turn it into an interesting garden feature. Or you could allow one of the branches, you could even wire it up a little bit, stake it up if you wanted to, but it'll do it on its own. You don't have to do that. We'll take over and the tree will gradually form a new leader. And yes, somewhere down the road, 10, 20 years down the road, the tree will be back to looking like you expected it to. Alternatively, you could plant a new version of the same thing nearby, or a similar or in complementary conifer nearby. And if I lived up there, that's probably what I would do. 15 to 20 feet away from this, so it has enough room to develop on its own. You'd regain the value of that beautiful excurrent growth habit of that conifer, and you could continue to shape this one that has now been pruned by nature into a more interesting garden feature. Either way, my inclination is always to leave a tree if it's healthy, even if it has an unusual form. One of the most important things I learned when I took a course in arboriculture, and this was from one of the leading arboriculture scientists in the world, Dr. Richard Harris. He took us on a bike tour around Davis. He made a point of taking us by two trees on this bike tour that had been allowed to grow up and then over and back down to the ground and then back up again. Serpentine. They had done it naturally on their own. Some of you may have seen the cork oak that he showed us, which is over on 8th Street. Some of you may have seen the sycamore or plane tree that has done it on Miller Drive. And they were perfectly healthy, perfectly stable. That's the important point he was making, but very unusual. And he said, you don't always have to follow the rules with a tree as long as it's safe. Okay, that was the key point he was making. This has been allowed to do something unusual. Kids could climb up on this snake-shaped tree trunk, and yet the tree had grown back up after doing this serpentine effect. So you can have a really interesting garden feature. You can work with the existing structure. You can enhance the existing unusual structure and have a real focal point in your yard, and conifers in particular. There's a long history, a long tradition of doing this, of shaping them as interesting garden features. So if the spouse is willing to do that, a little thinning, a little shaping, a little careful monitoring as the new leader forms, you could have a very interesting garden plant that way. Just make sure that you evaluate it every 3 to 5 years for safety, to make sure that there's not a conjoined leader, to make sure there isn't a branch at a bad angle, and so forth. So you want the tree to remain safe and stable, but it doesn't absolutely have to be shaped like a textbook. I guess that's the whole point that he was trying to make to us as beginning arboriculture students. And I do pass that along. There's a lot of training techniques on trees that we tell you about and pruning techniques, but you don't always have to follow the rules. It's okay to break the rules every now and then, as long as you don't do it in a manner that endangers people's, you know, endangers property or lives. So having a tree that's an unusual shape is cool.
Well, sometimes we get messages in email, and if you want to send it to us, you can send it to davisgardenshow@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. And sometimes Don writes down things that are conversations that he's had in his store. And this is one of those. Some folks came in and said, we're interested in ordering a peppercorn tree. Are there varieties that you recommend for Davis? And then in the discussion, they said, and we just want to verify that the peppercorns are red in color and edible. So a peppercorn tree, is that the California pepper tree, Don?
This opens up a whole can of worms. So this is one of the problems with common names of plants. The tree that we call California pepper is not a California native tree. It's actually from South America, Peru. Peruvian pepper was brought up into California by the Padres when they formed the missions along the coast of California. And they were planted there because they're incredibly tough. They're extremely well adapted to California. So California pepper properly should be called perhaps Peruvian pepper, but common names don't have any rules, is Schinus, S-C-H-I-N-U-S, species mole, M-O-L-L-E, Schinus mole, California pepper, Peruvian pepper, produces, it's a beautiful tree. It's always been one of my actual favorite trees. They're all over San Diego area and around most of the missions. Shiny leaves, looks sort of like a weeping willow, gets a fascinating bark that's real rugged looking. Even a 20-year-old California pepper looks like it's 100 years old because the bark is so fascinating. And it produces these red on the female trees. They're dioecious, so you have male and female trees. And on the female trees, you get these red berries. In some parts of coastal Southern California, the berries will reseed. They'll fall. We'll get to that in a moment. They'll fall to the ground and sprout. So some of you listening in Ventura County, San Diego County, it's considered invasive there. There is no evidence of this tree being invasive in Northern California. And I have more than 30 of them on my farm, which have been here since the mid-1980s. I've never seen a seedling come up. So that's anecdotal, but my guess is the seedlings don't survive the winter or need more irrigation perhaps to get past the seedling stage. So you'll sometimes read that this tree is invasive, coastal Southern California only, as far as I know. Tough, adaptable, beautiful, fascinating tree. The fruits from them have an interesting aroma to them, and they are resinous is the term I would use for it, and they are eaten. They're mildly toxic. So sometimes the peppercorns, as they're calling them, are blended with black pepper to make it more colorful, and ingesting a very small amount of it is not a particular concern. But it became clear to me in the conversation with this person, they were looking for the culinary purposes, not growing this tree for its beauty or its toughness. They were looking for the red pepper. Well, quick, Lois, what's a pepper?
Well, okay, so I'm allergic to pepper, but I'm allergic to the capsicum, which is the vegetable peppers, but not black pepper because it grows on a tree.
Right. The black pepper actually grows on a vine. And the reason capsicum, yes.
Wait a minute. What?
Yes. The reason capsicum peppers or, cayenne pepper, paprika, those types of peppers are called pepper is because they were spicy. They came from the Americas. The Portuguese took them back to Europe. as did Columbus, but the Portuguese in particular took them all along the spice routes they already had. And because they were spicy, sweet peppers didn't happen until like 100 years ago. For 200-300 years, all peppers were hot. Because they were spicy and resembled black peppers, they called them peppers. They called chili peppers peppers because they were like black pepper. That was where the name pepper came from. They didn't call them that in, you know, South America. They called them ají is the name for most peppers there. And they were all hot until there was a recessive gene that occurred in paprika in 1900 or so, which was a sweet pepper. That's where all the sweet peppers came from. Hot pepper, all peppers were hot once upon a time. And they're called peppers by Europeans because they resembled black pepper, which is a tropical vine. Okay. That produces peppers, which at one stage of development are black. At a different stage of development, they're white. In between, they may be pink or red. There's a red stage of peppercorn. And if they process them in a particular way, they're green. So this is a problem with the common name of pepper tree or peppercorn tree. Well, the fruit of Chinus mole is edible to a degree and is sometimes ingested, and it's colorful and it's often added to black pepper. They're not black pepper at all. They're just sometimes mixed in with it because they're decorative. But this is an important note. They're related to cashews. So if you happen to have a nut allergy to cashews, you may be allergic to California pepper, to the fruit of the California pepper. Other than that, there wouldn't be a particular concern. The mild toxicity of the peppercorns from a California pepper is not anything you'd need to be concerned about. But more to the point, one, if you're trying to grow it for the pepper for eating, this isn't probably what you're thinking of. Second, California pepper tree, although it is a beautiful tree in its place, it has aggressive roots. There's a constant litter from it. It's, you know, got a long history in California, and I love it, but I really only want to sell it to people in rural areas. It's one of those trees. If you're out in the country like I am, I needed to screen the freeway. I couldn't think of a better choice. And if you drive along the freeway, there they are, my 30 or so California peppers. I hand watered those with water jugs while they were young until I could get a drip line to them in the mid-1980s. I watered them with a drip line for about 10 years after that. I haven't given them any irrigation for at least 25 or 30 years, and they're doing just fine on their own. So it's a great tree for certain settings, but if you're looking for it for culinary purposes, you may be, hate to use this phrase, barking up the wrong tree. You probably mean the red variant of black peppercorns, which you can't grow because they're tropical plants.
Can you grow hypernigrum inside?
Yeah, in a greenhouse. I mean, it's a completely tropical plant. And so it was a really important part of the spice trade in the 1600s, 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, because it was, you know, it's powerful. It's got a lot of oomph to it and could be used to make recipes more exciting. And it was already on the spice trade when capsicums were brought in to Europe. And the history of that is quite fascinating. My father wrote a whole long thing about it years ago, but it was the Portuguese that really spread capsicum peppers, chili peppers, all over Asia, all the way into China. Well, here's the thing. They did that in the 1500s. Linnaeus invented taxonomy in the 1700s, a couple hundred years later. So here there were chili peppers growing in China. And when they were first brought to European taxonomists, they thought, oh, these must be native to China. So we have what we call the chinense peppers, capsicum chinensis, which are from China, except they weren't. They were cultivars that had been developed in China and throughout Asia over 200 years before anyone even thought to name plants. So all those habanero and the extremely hot peppers, the bujolkia and some of the others, the extremely, you know, the dangerously hot peppers, their origin is the Americas. They didn't originate in Asia, but they're called capsicum chinense. There you go.
Okay. Our next topic is, how do you propagate an African violet? Ooh, I know the answer to this.
Well, this is easy.
You take an African violet plant, you get a healthy leaf, you cut it off, and you can leave a long stem when you cut it. But then when you're going to root it, you want that stem to be shorter, because here's the key thing that a lot of people don't understand. If you put an African violet leaf with a long stem in a pot of water, the new leaves will grow out of the bottom of the stem. There'll be roots and a new plant way down there. So if you had if you grow it in water, you can see it. Mm-hmm. But if you just stick that in the dirt, those brand new little plants are trying to grow 2 inches underneath the soil. That's really difficult.
So an important thing about African violets and their relatives in the family Gisneriaceae is that you're actually just taking a petiole. It's not even stem. It's the leaf part. And most plants will not root or grow out of just a leaf part, a petiole. Most of them have to have a piece of stem with a node. If I give you a piece of a golden pothos, for example, you can see the node where the leaf is, and at the base of it, you can see the roots. They'll start to grow right out into the open air. So there's another easy plant to propagate. These are fun projects for young folks who are first getting into propagation. Both African violets and pothos and many of the houseplants are actually surprisingly easy to root. What's unique about African violets is they're rooting right out of the petiole, and they also root and put out new growth right there at the base of it. And you can watch it do that in water if you wish to do that.
I would prefer to not grow it in water, but to just take a leaf with a very short bit of petiole. Excuse me for calling that a stem. Yes. I know better. African violets have very strange stems with very, very short internodes. But if I take that and I put it in the dirt, but it's only like a half an inch there. And maybe I'll use an opened out paper clip or something to hold it in place. And then the little plant has a chance to actually come up. The other thing I've heard people talk about, and I'm not sure if it works, is if you take an African violet with a long stem and you put a tiny little cut in the African violet, just below where the leaf is at the top of the stem. And then you root it and you do things that where that cut happens, it will make a new plant. Now, I know that works with some of the other Gisneriaceae, but I don't think it works with African violet. Does it, Don?
I've never tried it. So that's an interesting question. They're so easy to root from a leaf petiole that that's the way most people do it. Now, one of the fun parts about doing it in the water and using a longer piece of petiole is you can watch the whole thing. You can put it in there. Just take a jar and fill it with water, put some saran wrap over the top and hold that in place with a rubber band and poke a hole with a pencil and stick it in there. You can watch, and this is the reason people like to do this, is that you can show people that first the roots come out, a little while later, the little fuzzy plant starts to grow. At some point, pretty quickly after that, you'll need to transplant it. And this is the part I always emphasize, especially when I'm talking to someone who's going to be doing this with kids. Every part of that is very fragile at that point. It is an easy way to root them. And you can take it out of there and very carefully put it partway into some soil. But it's going to be tippy and you're going to need to stabilize it. And you're going to want to try and keep the growing part out of the soil, not buried. So it's a little challenging. Oftentimes when I would do this, we would stake them with like a chopstick just to hold them in place, just to stabilize them. They do root in pretty quickly once you get them, but their roots break off easily. That growing point breaks off easily. So it can be fun to do it in water to watch it happen so you can see how it occurs. Then someone should guide the process of the actual planting into the soil. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.